Bonsoir, bonjour et bienvenue à notre dernière conférence de ce cycle qui porte sur le bien commun et la santé. J'ai le plaisir d'introduire Professor Alan Taylor. It took me a long time to find out indirectly whether Alan was male or female, but we did find out. It's a pleasure to have her with us, in spite of her difficulties with lost luggage and the rest. She did make it here this morning. She's not only our last speaker, it's also the last conference. Next year there will be no cycle de conférence parce que je serai en sabbatique. Alors, c'est le temps de prendre ici. Je vais nulle part, mais je vais avoir le temps de penser et d'écrire ici. Donc,
vous allez
me déranger, d'accord. Professor Alan Taylor has a joint appointment at the University of Maryland School. She's both in medicine and in law. And so she fits perfectly with the chair as well. And she's an adjunct professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins. Next year, she just informed me, she will be joining the Georgetown University Law Center. It's a new project. I don't know if you've heard of it, Larry Gostin. Si quelqu'un travaille en vie privée, on sait voir qui c'est Larry Gostin. Received quite a large grant to start a new global health law program. And you're going to be part of that program, I think. She's also been very active, and we were trying to figure out why we never crossed paths at WHO, in particular in the field of the development of the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. And Professor Taylor told me that normally she has lots of slides when she talks about tobacco, with enough to make you lose your appetite, but it's not the subject of the speech today, so she will do, a proper law lecture without slides and without PowerPoint. She's also advised the world, the Pan American Health Organization, the Overseas Development Council, and the World Bank. Her law degree is from California at Berkeley, and her master's and doctorate in international law from Columbia University, where she was a Ford Foundation Fellow in Public International Law. She has written extensively on global health law, policy concerns, tobacco control, biotechnology, human rights, international health, security, and communicable diseases control. So I think we have all the subjects of the year rolled into one person. So it's my pleasure to welcome you, and in spite of your difficulties and the awful weather, to welcome you to Montreal.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming to this presentation. I'd like to express my deep appreciation to Professor Knoppers, the Canada Chair, Research Chair in Law and Medicine, for inviting me here today. I'm delighted to be back in Montreal. I actually had my honeymoon here, and it brings back very lovely memories. But as Professor Knoppers mentioned, I'm feeling a bit scruffy, underdressed, and I know, out of sorts because of the difficulties I had in coming here, but I have to say, you know, some dirty clothes and a lack of personal hygiene, or somewhat of a lack of personal hygiene, gets put into a bit of perspective when we start thinking about the issues of global health governance. I'm hoping that you'll bear with me today. Well, to begin with, in the last decade and a half, the field of global health has evolved into a principal realm of global public policy. And as I'm sure you're all aware, traditionally public health was viewed as a narrow technical concern. Multilateral cooperation was restricted to discrete areas, and global health was seen as almost the exclusive province of physicians and other public health specialists. But today, the reality of global public health is altogether different. With burgeoning numbers of new global health actors and staggering amount of new resources and money, global health has transformed from a mere technical domain into an issue of high politics. Today, health is universally recognized as integral to security, trade, and interconnected with almost all other areas of international concern. Now, the growth and importance of world health in the last 15 years is just unprecedented. Clearly, the context of global health has changed, and it's changed quickly and radically. How this has happened, why this has happened, and how can we harness the newfound status, interest, and resources in global health to make an important difference in protecting and promoting world health is really the questions that dominate global health governance today. What's important to note that despite progress in many areas, Global health governance today is recognized as in crisis. Overall advancement in world health is insufficient, and notwithstanding all of the new resources, in some areas, health is in fact going backwards. And it's widely recognized that global health governance is in critical need of reform. Well, this afternoon, I'd like to trace to you some of the underlying forces contributing to the emergence of health as a key political concern and the current crisis in global health governance. Of particular importance, of course, is the globalization of public health. We'll then examine some of the key challenges in the contemporary architecture of global health governance and the current demands for global health governance reform, particularly in the area of global health law. Well, to begin with, the high-level attention to global health since the mid-90s is due to a significant extent to the recognition that globalization has precipitated a very strong relationship between health, security, and development. It's widely observed, of course, that globalization has critical implications for public health and public health governance. A dominant characteristic of globalization is that it has introduced or expanded risks to health that transcend national borders in their origin and impact. For example, growth in international trade and travel in combination with population growth has served to increase the frequency and intensity of health concerns that are bypassing or spilling over sovereign borders. Such health concerns include emerging and re-emerging infectious diseases, global environmental degradation, food safety, as well as trade in harmful commodities. Now, although health has been traditionally viewed as a limited realm of multilateral cooperation, there's growing awareness that globalization has contributed to the proliferation of these cross-border determinants of health. Consequently, globalization is increasingly understood as undermining the capacity of states to protect health through domestic action alone, and has created a heightened need for coordinated intergovernmental action. For example, the magnitude of the global impact of catastrophic appearances of new infectious diseases and the reemergence of old contagions has vividly evidenced the inadequacy of conventional unilateral national approaches to protecting public health. Over the last two decades, the global community has been confronted with outbreaks of virulent and drug-resistant strains of old infections, most recently on XDR-TB. We've also battled over 30 recognized new pathogens during the same period, of course, most importantly, HIV-AIDS. And most recently, the well-publicized outbreaks of SARS in 2002 and 2003 and the threat of avian flu have captured public and media attention and powerfully evidenced the globalization of public health. And of course, the SARS outbreak is well known here in Canada, but I want to say globally, the SARS outbreak was remarkably significant because it taught us that the epidemiologist's worst-case scenario can in fact come true. Diseases do not respect borders. SARS spread rapidly from its origins in southern China until it had reached 29 countries in just a matter of months. It took AIDS 25 years to do the same. But SARS also showed us that virulent infectious diseases, for all their force and might, can be contained if there is effective international cooperation and surveillance. Now, although SARS ultimately had a very limited impact on world health, the magnified public attention to this disease, as well as its significant economic consequences, essentially jolted global awareness and appreciation of the interconnectedness of domestic and international health. Consequently, SARS had a singular impact in raising the political profile of health, and it in fact jump-started the revision of the WHO international health regulation process. Now, in this era of globalization, health has risen to a new political space, or what Alona Kickbush has artfully described as a new political ecosystem of high politics. Health is now in the mainstream of foreign policy. Health is no longer regarded as a mere technical humanitarian concern, but it's linked to most other realms of international policy. For example, the spread of acute and deadly infections that I have described has raised the profile of health in security policy, nationally and internationally. And as a further example, the recognition that health is critically linked to economic growth and social stability has made a health a core part of the larger, more comprehensive economic development agenda. Global health is also increasingly understood to be linked to most other international regimes, including environment, trade, human rights, and arms control. For example, the extraordinary growth in international trade in this era of globalization means that the link between health and trade in a number of the World Trade Organization's WTO treaties is becoming increasingly apparent. In a wide range of areas, including access to medicines, food security, health services, infectious disease control, and biotechnology. The recognition of the links between health and international trade, particularly in the context of the WTO TRIPS agreement on intellectual property, has put health on the core agenda of trade policies. Now, in this new global health ecosystem, health is no longer the exclusive preserve of health ministers of WHO or public health specialists. Global health is now the core agenda of many states, the United Nations, the G8, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and other major multilateral institutions. Some of the most striking developments in this new international health arena are the increase in the types and numbers of non-state actors. Traditionally, global health policy was dominated by states acting alone or through international organizations. But in addition to states and international organizations, global health today is populated by multinational corporations, perhaps most importantly, pharmaceutical industry, non-governmental organizations, philanthropic foundations such as Gates, Rockefeller, and Bloomberg, public-private partnerships such as the Global Fund for AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, universities, and health research networks, and most recently, individual entrepreneurs such as Jeffrey Sachs of Harvard, or Bono, as I understand he's now called, Bono of U2, Sir Bono. He was knighted last week. Well, the rapid proliferation of non-state actors in international health is just stunning. It's estimated that there are more than 60,000 NGOs and 150 public-private partnerships operating in international health today. The theoretical and practical significance of non-state actor involvement in international health is hotly contested. Excuse me one second. Today, non-state actors deliver a significant portion of health services in developing countries and have arguably eclipsed the traditional functions of international organizations. At the same time, the size and resources of some non-state actors, such as the Gates Foundation and the pharmaceutical industry, make them a potent force outside of the state system in shaping global public health policy. Excuse me. The redirection of functions and programs from international organizations to the non-state sector clearly has significant consequences in terms of priority setting, control, and accountability in international health. And according to some, very interestingly, the dominance of the non-state sector has ultimately reduced the significance of the UN system. Notably, the proliferation of new actors in global health has also come hand in hand with a staggering increase in new resources in global health. Now, in a recent article in Foreign Affairs, Lori Garrett correctly reminded us that less than a decade ago in global health, the biggest issue seemed to be a lack of resources. If only we had more money. But today, thanks to an extraordinary rise in public and private giving, more money is directed to international health than ever before. Overseas development assistance, every OECD nation skyrocketed between 2001 and 2005, with health making up the largest portion of the increase. In the United States alone, ODA skyrocketed from about $11 billion in 2001 to $28 billion in 2005. And in 2005, the G8 states, which account for roughly 75% of the value of all development assistance expenditure, actually pledged to double overseas development assistance by $25 billion by the year 2010. And of course, the increase has not just come from states. There's been a tremendous surge in charitable giving and health globally. As of August 2006, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation alone has given away about $6 billion. The World Bank, for its part, has steadily increased financing for health since it first put health on its agenda in the mid-90s. While the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and Malaria had approved almost $7 billion in proposals since its founding in 2002 and has given away close to $3 billion. Now, overall, there's more money in global health and more non-governmental organizations and other actors competing to spend it than ever before. Now, with health heightened new political profile and billions of dollars on the table, it would seem reasonable to expect that the global community would be making some serious progress in global health. But unfortunately, this is not the case. While globalization has improved the health of billions, a large part of the world has been left behind. And there's considerable concern that the insertion of vast new resources and actors in global health is actually compounding existing challenges rather than advancing effective solutions. And perhaps most importantly, visionary leadership to harmonize, rationalize, and coordinate global health governance is lacking. Now, the challenges of contemporary global health governance are pervasive, and I'd just like to mention a few. First of all, the cross-cutting nature of global health that I've described suggests that the political agenda of global health should, in fact, be far-reaching. But this is not the case. Most funds from public sources today come with strings attached and must be spent according to donors' narrow set of priorities, policy values, and not necessarily according to public health needs. Now, in the context of the United States and the President's PEPFAR-AIDS program, this is probably well known, but it's true more generally. For example, a review of the G8's official development assistance patterns evidences that the key list of global priorities targeted for international assistance are largely limited to the health-related problems of developing countries that are somehow narrowly perceived as threatening the vital security of industrialized countries. Ronald LeBlanc from the University of Ottawa has done a number of detailed studies in this area, evidencing that the donor framework focuses almost exclusively on infectious diseases and bioterrorism. Now, notably, as ODA has been largely steered towards fighting communicable diseases, the share of ODA directed towards primary care has, in fact, been declining and now constitutes less than 15% of all assistance. Now, importantly, governments have been joined in their efforts to fight specific diseases by private donors, and that's most notably by the Gates Foundation. Consequently, money being put into international assistance today by public and private sources is largely spent on issue-specific vertical disease programs such as AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria, and not on horizontal systemic measures designed to strengthen national public health systems. Now, the key problem of the vertical approach is that many national governments have simply not prioritized public health. Decades of neglect of national public health systems have left local hospitals, clinics, laboratories, and human services just decimated. And without functioning public health systems and infrastructure, as well as rampant corruption that exists in many states, funds devoted to disease-specific efforts are being drained or flushed away often without meaningful or sustainable impact. Now, the lack of coordination among donors is also a significant problem. Indeed, cooperation, competition rather than coordination is a hallmark of donor activities, leading to waste, duplication, and fragmentation of global health efforts. In sub-Saharan Africa, for example, there are frequent complaints of the multiplicity of efforts coming from states, international organizations, NGOs, and others simply outstrips the governance capacity of many countries and ultimately undermines public health. And I have to say that this is an old complaint. I mean, this has been a complaint of all your life, being in public health. And now with the huge amount of new resources and actors, the problem is insurmountable. Nancy Birdsall, in a recent study, gave the example of Tanzania, which had 1,300 donor projects, remarkably, between 2001 and 2002, requiring that it produce 2,400 reports each and every quarter. We need to understand the limitations of technical resources that exist in developing countries to understand the extraordinary bureaucratic burden placed on them by the failure to coordinate aid efforts. I had the opportunity to spend time in the Ministry of Health in Tanzania a few years before Birdsall's study, and at that time there was only one lawyer in the entire Ministry of Health, and there were no resources available to gather, analyze, and update the ancient public health law that was governing the country. Overall, there's serious concern today that despite the fact that for the first time in history, the world is poised to spend enormous resources for health, the money spent will have very limited impact, if any. In fact, despite progress in many areas, overall advancement in world health is insufficient, and in some cases, going backwards. For example, the infectious disease environment is changing for the worse. Newly emergent diseases and antimicrobial resistance are eroding decades of gains made against communicable diseases. Most notably, of course, is HIV/AIDS, and it's a devastating effect on poor countries. After billions of dollars and almost two decades of global health advocacy, the lack of progress in fighting AIDS is palpable. As a further example, health research and development are increasingly concentrated in the private pharmaceutical sector, which is contributing little to alleviating the diseases of the most vulnerable populations. Technological innovations have not reduced costs or increased access to medicines globally. And perhaps most importantly, international assistance has failed to put a dent in tackling the fundamental health security issue of our time. That is the issue of health inequity, or breaking that link that exists between poverty and inadequate health. Disparities in wealth and health are widening inexorably, and rapid economic globalization has failed to reduce poverty and improve health for all. Globalization has not been, as quoting someone, a rising tide that has lifted all boats. And despite the staggering new resources and activities in global health, in 2005, the United Nations Development Program reported an unprecedented reversal in human development. 18 of the world's poorest countries registered lower scores on the Human Development Index than they had 15 years before in the year 1990. Well, this picture that I painted for you today depicts a global health system that's failing to meet fundamental needs and expectations. Clearly, the disease-specific approach that has dominated global health has not moved health significantly forward. And increasingly, scholars are arguing that current challenges in global health are not, in fact, disease-based challenges, but, in fact, challenges of global governance. Now, personally, I would hesitate to put down all the reasons for failure in global health to issues of governance alone, but I hope I've illustrated for you today that health is profoundly political. The challenges of leadership prioritization, coordination, and fragmentation that I've described clearly mandate some governance reform that we're going to move global health efforts forward. Now, governance must be addressed on multiple fronts, nationally and internationally. At the national level, governments must build sustainable public health capabilities locally and at the national level. It's impossible to establish an effective global governance system without an adequate foundation, adequate building blocks existing at the national level and within countries. And as I suggested before, in my view, the clear lack of commitment to address the systemic issues of poverty and ill health through strengthening of these national public health services and sustainable financing to do so is perhaps our most difficult challenge. We need to recognize that for all the fanfare of the Millennium Development Goals of 2000 and Millennium Plus 5 2 years ago, developing countries and donor nations have been unwilling to commit themselves legally or financially to seriously addressing this link between poverty and ill health. Now, at the global level, the governance system needs a strong base that ensures health security, provides global public goods, and provides international support to tackle the health problems of poor states. And it must also support, in its efforts, the codification and implementation of international norms to provide an effective framework for international cooperation. I think it's interesting that the governance issue that has received perhaps the least attention in the literature is this governance or management of the emerging field of global health law. You know, as an international lawyer who spent most of her career developing and negotiating health law treaties, perhaps comes as no surprise that that's my key area of interest. Importantly, it appears that most scholars and practitioners in global health today appear to accept without question the idea that treaties are a core component of global health governance. I mean, it's actually sort of routinely said in the literature. And that alone is a remarkable development. A professor in Nauvoo is looking on knowingly that 10 to 15 years ago, global health law was not even a recognized subset or subdiscipline of international law, and there was strong resistance within WHO and elsewhere to this idea of global health lawmaking, or what one WHO official described as the making of official science. Now, today, of course, the political scenario of global public health has changed. The momentum of globalization is as such is that governments are turning increasingly to international cooperation to attain national public health objectives, including international health lawmaking. Today, the emerging field of international health law encompasses treaties and other legal instruments that address diverse and complex concerns, such as aspects of biomedical science, environmental health, the marketing of harmful commodities, and infectious disease control. Global health law is also recognized as integrally linked to most other international legal disciplines. Now, the field of global health law presents its own unique governance problems. In particular, in the absence of effective leadership by the WHO, international health lawmaking shows potential for uncoordinated and inefficient sprawl. Now, I've written extensively about these issues of global health law governance, but have no time, I don't have time today to delve into the details of the challenges, but I would like to leave you with two ideas about emerging issues in global health law governance. First of all, we need to recognize that there's currently no rational approach to law creation or means of identifying priority legislative projects. This creates a tremendous burden on the international system. International lawmaking is slow, expensive, cumbersome, and in the end, an inherently limited process. Consequently, international legislative projects should be initiated with great care. And I'd say, I know with dismay, the number of articles I read in Global Health Law is calling for new treaties. Whatever the problem, we need a new treaty. We need to think more carefully before we recognize a treaty. Today, any member state can drop any idea for a treaty in the hopper of a relevant international organization, and the idea can be taken up whether or not it reflects a priority concern to the international community, and in some cases, when it clearly does not. In my opinion, this has happened a few times, and arguably one I'll be willing to admit to is I think this is arguably just what happened in one of the most recent international legislative projects, in particular the failed Sixth Committee negotiations for a treaty banning reproductive human cloning. In my opinion, this is just not a priority global health concern that really deserves the attention and resources of the world community at this time. Now, the process by which the international community decides upon international legislative projects needs rationalization to make global health lawmaking a more effective means of international cooperation. Now, second and finally, a critical challenge in ensuring the effective development of global health law in the future and better global health law governance is the inherent limitations of the traditional state-centered context of international law. As is well known, non-states are excluded from the web of cooperative relationships established by international law. International law is a closed system and is a system for states. The rise of new global health actors, including civil society, private industry, and the philanthropic organizations, has considerably complexified health governance and highlighted this fundamental limitation of a traditional state-centered focus of international law. Constructing a more effective dialogue between states and a network of other global health actors will be a critical component of better collective management of global health law and global health governance in the future. Well, in conclusion, I hope my presentation today has illustrated that global health governance, including the governance of global health law, is at a crossroads. The question that remains is whether the unprecedented metamorphosis of health into an international political issue that we have witnessed over the last decade will ultimately produce a new and more effective means of governance. Thank you for your patience and for your consideration.
Thank you very much, Professor Taylor. We have some questions, if you're willing to take
sure.
some questions. Yeah? Questions? Rosario?
Thank you. I couldn't agree more on your point that human reproductive cloning is not a priority in terms of law and health. However, I would like to ask you, what do you think about a treaty setting a precedent on bioethics and human rights? I was part of the negotiations on the UN advising Germany and France, and we all agree that cloning, human reproductive cloning, is far richer from occurring, and of course that's more important issue, especially for developing countries in terms of global health. However, with the genomics revolution and with the translation, international collaborative projects, etc., setting the precedent of international treaty developed on the UNESCO Declaration on Bioethics and Human Rights will be of importance. What are your comments on that?
Well, first of all, thank you for your interest. I think that presents a very interesting question. I've written myself arguing that there should be a treaty on the human genome and human rights. But I think there were a couple problems, and my research on this is a little bit old. I did attend part of the negotiation for that treaty. I mean, part of the problem here is that many countries have not really thought of these issues, certainly at the time, and there was a real paucity of legislation at the national level. So the problem is, if you come to an international arena and there's nothing happening at the national level, it leaves those, you know, in the arena without direction or guidance. I mean, I think part of what UNESCO, and I think it is UNESCO, needed to do was to develop dialogue, and I know it has worked on this, and this is your expertise, at the national level, before we can actually provide an overriding framework at the global level. And you know, the negotiations for the reproductive cloning treaty occurred in the sixth committee of the UN, which is the lawyers' committee. They're the best lawyers in the world. I mean, these were very, very smart people. But most of them had no direction, and ultimately it was a political issue. My other problem with it, I mean, is that the treaty that you're describing is not what actually happened. It was supposed to be a treaty on reproductive cloning that the United States tried to expand to include all cloning. And part of the problem is that, and you would know this, where you worked with the French and the Germans, is that it was not carefully planned out. You know, the way these international legislation, any country can drop a treaty in the hopper, but there's usually underlying discourse, you know, before. There's a checking of all your partners, the state partners. And the problem that happened here is the French and Germans did not check the political pulse of the United States, which, in my opinion, is unfortunately in a very bad place, you know, at the national level. And so they decided, well, this is a quick and easy treaty. Everyone will agree to banning reproductive cloning, but the Bush administration and its the religious right had very different ideas. So it wound up just being a hugely expensive waste of resources. And my opinion was that the Sixth Committee did not want to be involved in this. You know, they negotiated arms control agreements. They didn't want to get into this political debate, ultimately, about where life begins. I mean, you all understand that's really where this negotiation is headed. You know, is whether we're going to ban reproductive cloning or all cloning because they involve the destruction of the human embryo, which is where the Bush administration was. And it was able to bring, ultimately, I think about 35 countries along in that same perspective. So I do agree with you, but I don't think it really changes my underlying argument.
Before we get to the next question, what would you say when you thought there could be a treaty on genomics and human rights? How did you originally acquiesce more in that direction? What did you have in mind?
You know, I'd say I'd have to think about that because it's been, a few years. I mean, there was quite a number, obviously, of issues that would be involved in a treaty on genomics and human rights. You know, for me, as an international health lawyer, the major concern is ensuring equitable sharing of the resources from genomics, and that, you know, has not been addressed, at any level. There's also concerns about changes of the human species that need to be addressed. So there are multiple concerns. This was actually almost 10 years ago that I was writing on this, but at the time I was more impressed with how few countries had actually given any attention, even industrialized countries, to the multiplicity of issues. I'm actually very interested to hear what your view is on that. You're expert here.
Well, you put me on the spot. Probably 10 years ago, I would have been more in favor than I am now. So luckily, we were talking about this earlier, most treaties or declarations or whatever take about that much time, thank goodness, in any event. And it can have a counter... it can have the effect that I'm not even talking about restraints on trade or restraints on or economic secondary effects that you could not have imagined. I think it's more creating speciesism or creating some sort of notion, static notion of nature, that nature is static and so we have to keep it safe and secure. And so all these notions that have no scientific basis actually could be reflected if we were to go further than the UNESCO Universal Declaration, which I think still serves its purpose. But to go to a treaty level would probably result in the same unexpected effects like the diversity, the Rio 1992 convention, which has slowed down exchange of animal and plant materials between countries, has actually, through the principle of state sovereignty, harmed international sharing of resources and accesses to resources. So I think we have to, I'm glad that we didn't do anything beyond the UNESCO as a principled guideline as opposed to a treaty with sanctions.
Yeah, so interesting. When we went to the climbing negotiations at WHO, one of the things that struck me was that the multiplicity of like lawmaking authority here, and that's actually one of the I alluded to, that you have this potential for sprawl, lack of coordination, because that treaty effort and actually anything in genetics could be brought to the UN, it could be brought to UNESCO, and it could be brought to WHO. And I was really clearly curious as to why the UNESCO representative was there. What were they thinking? Part of what they may have been thinking was, why is this happening at the UN? Why isn't this happening at UNESCO? Why didn't the French and Germans bring this effort to UNESCO?
Because
the
UNESCO didn't want it.
Oh, they asked? They did ask?
Yes.
And let me tell Jean, she's the former chair of the UNESCO International Bioethics Committee, the one that developed the Universal Declaration.
This is very interesting.
you're amongst the pals here.
I think that the sole reason either reversed because the UN process was started by France and Germany, and it was not going very well. So, as you say, people were not prepared because that or whatever. Yeah. And then Chirac came to the UNESCO and said, UNESCO has to do something. And I was chairing the International Bioethics Committee at that time, so we met with him, and he wanted a convention. And as you say, we found that countries were not prepared, you know, to have a convention, so we worked on a declaration, basically saying that following the adoption declaration, things would happen at the regional and local level. And I think that this is happening now. The next, I'm not the chair anymore, the next IBC meeting will be in Kenya. The last one was, I think, in Asia somewhere, whatever. So they're trying to build this sort of capacity at the regional and local level, because as you say, some government have never heard about these things first. Second, your stuff about the global governance is very important, because as sat as a visiting minister at WHO for 4 years, and WHO is by itself a political animal, right? And when you want to talk about global governance or setting up a committee to look at that, you have those ministers standing out, no, you won't intrude in my country, it's culture, it's diversity, and all that stuff. And so it's so difficult, and I think We'll not get anywhere if we don't try to talk about these things. You will not have international legislation if governments don't want to talk. Right. The only thing they have to say, this doesn't fit in my country. This doesn't fit with my legislation. And raising this thing is very, very, very difficult. And the point you made at the beginning, the connection between trade and health and all that stuff, it's there. And you have countries in Africa where they spend 2% of their budget on health.
Right.
On health. And I asked some physician, well, doesn't make sense to me, where is the 98% going? Well, corruption, army, military stuff. So who's going to talk about that?
Right.
And sometimes we have some meetings with developed countries, and we felt, do we kill WHO and do something else? But you cannot do that. But anyway, this is major.
Well, you raised so many interesting points. I mean, first of all, this is the Universal Declaration of Human Genome and Human Rights. I appreciate being educated on this. You know, it's often the case in the UN system that treaties begin first by having some kind of a resolution. It starts as an educative function and jumpstarts countries. And I think this is actually what happened with the Universal Declaration, is that it's moved countries along to thinking about these important issues. Because you have to also be very careful about the offers. Sometimes you can spend a lot of time negotiating which is certainly the universal declaration took a while to negotiate, correct? You can take a very long time to negotiate a non-binding instrument. To the end of the day, have a non-binding instrument. Okay?
We took only one year.
I worked on tobacco, and I developed the idea of the WHO Framework Convention, and there was a lot of push on tobacco to do a non-binding instrument. I was very concerned. Well, there's been a lot of non-binding instruments on tobacco, and the industry didn't want to exactly just to do that, to do something, you know, non-binding. So in this case, it's worked very well. And, you know, and it seems to have moved the process forward. The points you make of WHO, of course, are absolutely correct. I mean, it's a bureaucratic nightmare. You know, I was a staff member for 7 years. I've been consultant for many more. The problem is, it is the core international institution, international institution in global health, right? It's a specialized agency in health. It has the largest amount of resources. It has a constitutional directive to act as directing and coordinating authority in international health. And here's an important point. While we've had this proliferation of non-state actors and other actors in international health, they can eclipse a number of the functions of an international organization, right? The one thing they cannot eclipse is the lawmaking function of international organizations. Most international legislative projects today occur within an international organization with relevant lawmaking authority. It is very rare to have treaties happen outside. Of course, we have the case of the Landmines Convention that was negotiated here, right? Yeah. But that is actually the exception. So I have advocated, recognizing all the limitations, that WHO needs to take on this role. Because they have it. And who else is going to do it? Like the Sixth Committee? I actually think the lawyers are the best, but they don't want to take on the, you know, they're not interested. Third Committee. UNESCO has a more limited legal mandate. So we need to see WHO step up to the plate. And there's, you know, we can be very discouraged about this, or we can think in a cup half full, or three quarters full sort of way of how far we've gone. International health lawmaking, I mean, it is true. 10, 15 years ago, you couldn't get anyone at WHO to really talk about these issues, and there was resistance. And we've seen a great deal of change.
I'm sure there's lots of other questions. Professor Taylor, Denise?
I'm sort of really interested in the fact that you really highlighted the importance of how we're attempting to deal with these international health problems, disease by disease, and that we really need a systems approach, and you gave the example of public health. But I have two questions regarding that. One, do you see that this public health approach really is a strong one? It doesn't have to compete with the healthcare system approach, because we hear that in developing countries, oftentimes they'll have the most exotic intensive care units, let's say, for premature babies. That's where a lot of money, always called health, went into an area which is really having the least amount of impact. So I'm just interested in your experience, how much public health competes with the health service system. And then the other one is, how does public health, or why should public health be highlighted as being the system rather than take a determinant of health approach, which would say the education, the economics, all of these have to operate with sort of equal timing or strength in trying to address a global health problem?
First of all, the question on the public health, you know, services versus health support, I'm going to actually have to defer on this one. I really don't have the expertise. I did do work with WHO in the 90s. Working within countries, and my primary expertise is as an international lawyer, so I don't really have the expertise to answer that question. On your second question, a health system, perhaps, you know, my shorthand version, I gave, you know, sort of a misguiding answer, you know, on this, because, I mean, it is accepted that to properly address health today, you have to look at health holistically, not just in terms of, you know, public health institutions, but, you know, education, nutrition, housing, and so forth. And that's actually what I was trying to get at in this discussion on the link between poverty and ill health. We need to look at the root cause. Sorry, I apologize that I'm giving some impressions on that.
I would like to hear your comments about globalization of public mental health. Do you have...
Tell me, expertise. Is that the area that you work on?
Because I'd be very
interested.
In fact, I'm a psychiatrist and I have public health training, but I'm not involved at the international thing, but this you are aware of the depression pandemics that is occurring, and that in 2020 it will be the second most important burden health problem. So as you mentioned, I think it's more at the education, culture, and determinants of health that the challenges could be addressed. But I wonder if that the law, international lawmaking, there is a thinking about that challenge.
I'm curious as to the characterization of the mental health, like depression, being a pandemic.
The incidence and prevalence of depression is skyrocketing right now.
Right. So let me think of tobacco as a pandemic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because even though that it's socially contagious.
Yeah.
Is this the same? Is it similar?
The environment. It's the environment in which people live that maybe they don't find the meaning in life as much as they did before.
This is not obviously not my area of expertise. I actually wish I had my old colleague, Derek Yoff, with me. Derek Yoff? He was the executive director of non-communicable diseases and mental health at WHO when I was there. He's now a professor at Yale. I mean, the only thing I could say to this is that what I tried to bring up in my presentation is that the overall focus in global health efforts is on infectious diseases, right? And the critique of this is that it's underplaying significantly non-communicable diseases and mental health, right? That are a significant proportion of the problems. I mean, the infectious disease issue is obviously very important. But it's even there. It tends to be focused on things like AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. You look at diarrheal-based diseases. 1.9 million people die every year. There's just no group that's sort of waving the fanfare for addressing diarrheal diseases. And similarly, you don't see the kind of attention, except for this tobacco tree, which was really WHO-driven, on non-communicable diseases for mental health. And, some people could argue that this is related to the industrialized world, again, focusing on, the issues that are important to it. Because if you think about the infectious diseases, the reason that the G8 put so much money into this is that their concern is that these are diseases that are spreading from the south to the north. They're either spreading directly or economically, with their economic consequences. So meanwhile, issues that may spread north-south, such as tobacco, and I don't know enough about mental health, but I imagine that there are some concerns about issues spreading from the north to the south are just not on the agenda. And I wish I could tell you more.
Thank you.
You mentioned the rise of the non-state actors and at the same time a disease focus. Religious groups were not mentioned among your 60,000 NGOs or whatever, but the focus on disease and the... could also be related to the fact that the naming of disease does not evoke any religious, cultural, or socially contained in certain regimes or countries or religions. So you focus on the disease and you hide the fact that you're using NGOs, sometimes either religious-driven NGOs, or you cut back on, let's say, Planned Parenthood, because Planning Parenthood is not a disease. I mean, I'm just wondering how you can balance internationally the disease focus, which hides the fact that you're using it because you don't want to get into embryo debates or contraception debates or women's rights debates. And so that's maybe one reason why everyone's comfortable with disease, because it doesn't seem to be culturally laden with any values. Well, at the same time, they're free to go, obviously, but religious groups under the guise of public health to actually go over and proselytize or whatever you want to call it.
I have to say that's an interesting conundrum. I haven't thought of sort of the interplay before.
it's just from experience, having been involved with Planned Parenthood in the 70s and so on, where the funding, when the administration changed to a conservative administration in the states, all the clinics then were cut off from any American. But when it was a disease focus, let's say smallpox eradication, suddenly money was there. So there's just also political politics based on values that are hidden under the amount of money going into.
Well, I mean, of course, in the case of in the U.S., a lot of the values are not hidden at all. I mean, they're actually very clear. I actually saw on Canadian, CNN last night, complaints at the national level what's happening with, the public health system in the U.S. I mean, we're all familiar with PEPFAR in the U.S., the United States Presidential Program on AIDS. And meanwhile, this is a context that, the president has actually increased the focus on international health, tremendously, but... Yeah, it's tied up with religion in so many ways. I mean, they have the ABC approach, abstinence, be faithful, and condoms. But they've forgotten the condoms, and now, a lot of this money, is focused on abstinence and be faithful. And if you know anything about the epidemiology of AIDS, it's just a waste. I mean, the worst place to be in the developing world is as a married woman. Married women are at the highest risk of getting AIDS, from Malaysia to Kenya. So there's that. There's a third of money must go to faith-based initiatives as well. I mean, there's just, there's tremendous concern that this is working. And one of the more recent issues about the presidential program, that they are not allowing funding to go to programs that work with prostitutes. So, also family planning. So you're not really reaching out to the groups
in primary care.
And this is the choice also, just even in the U.S., this program focuses on abstinence in U.S. high schools. And, you only need to take, an introductory public health class to tell you, that's just not enough, to protect our children. So.
Mm-hmm. Any last question? Yes? Go ahead.
I really liked your presentation.
Thank you.
I agree with lots of the points that you brought. What I was wondering, because you're proposing that we coordinate international legislation of public health, but for the success of a public health effort, they need to be applied at national level. So how do you see that these legislation to be incorporated at a national level?
Well, that's actually a very good point. And I mentioned the example of Tanzania, which, a decade ago had one, lawyer in the health ministry. I mean, this is a good point, and I haven't articulated before, is that if you're going to strengthen legislation at the national, at the international level, you also need to strengthen it, at the national level. I mean, there are a number of scholars, especially in the environmental arena, have given a good deal of consideration to this, because what we're talking about is developing complex regulatory systems. And that places a tremendous challenge for developing countries. Old style international treaties, the Dan Arms Control, say, do not produce nuclear weapons. Well, that's actually fairly easy to do, if you're at the level of a nation. You just don't produce them, right? It doesn't take complex regulatory systems. But here, if you want to, for example, in the case of tobacco, establish an entire system to educate people and discourage people and develop programs on not smoking in public places, you need to build this huge regulatory context. Mm-hmm. So part of what we need to do as an international community is assist countries in building capacity in legislation at the national level.
That's a good role for law students and Well, I'd like to, at the end of this series, not forget to thank Marie-Angèle Yangeli, Sabrina Fortin, and Dominique Gauthier, and also our speaker of today. Thank you very much.
Yeah.